Shalom. Welcome to another episode of Inspiration from Zion. I'm Jonathan Feldstein, and I have the privilege of being your host coming to you from the Judean Mountains here in Israel. I like to refer to it as the original Bible Belt. Inspiration from Zion is a program of the Genesis 123 Foundation, whose mission is to build bridges between Jews and Christians with Israel in ways that are new, unique, and meaningful. I pray that you will find this, all of those. Through this program, we're excited to connect you to people and stories in and relating to Israel to give you a window to look through, experiencing aspects of life here that you might not otherwise know about. We want this to be interactive, so please be in touch with us at inspirationfromzion@gmail.com and send along any questions and any comments about any topic anytime. Or you can be in touch with us at genesis123.co or follow and like Inspiration from Zion on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Stay tuned until the end, when we're also going to share an exciting opportunity, and please feel free to share this with others who will also find it of interest. So today's topic is something, first of all, today's guests we've had as guests of Inspiration from Zion before, and I'm really excited to have them back in a completely different context. And it's the context is a conversation that we've also had on Inspiration from Zion, but also not in this context. We are going to address It's actually the first episode in 6 months, and as we record, it's 180 days since the beginning of the war, the Hamas massacre on October 7th, and it's the first episode that we are recording that's not exactly directly 100% related, but it is related. It's related indeed, because we're going to talk about Jews making Aliyah, coming home to Israel, and especially now, and why especially now. And I'm going to introduce our guests in alphabetical order, but then we're going to roll it around and play some games in terms of who's going to speak, because it was actually triggered by our second guest, the reason for this conversation. Hillel Fold, our first guest, was named Israel's top marketer and the man transforming the startup nation to the scale-up nation by Forbes, and is a tech journalist, startup marketer, and technology expert. Hillel was recently named the 7th most influential tech blogger on the internet and among the top 100 most influential social media personalities across the globe. Hillel also speaks publicly on topics including marketing, entrepreneurship, Israeli tech, and his personal story and business philosophy. What Hillel is most proud of is his family, including his wife Racheli and their 5 amazing kids. He also takes pride that he uses his extensive network to help hundreds of people get jobs in the Israeli tech ecosystem. You can read more about Hillel's work and connect with him at hillelfold.com. Rabbi Chaim Leiter studied at the Jewish Theological Seminary for Education and Yeshivat Chovei Torah and Yeshivat HaMivtar for his rabbinical ordination. He made Aliyah in 2009 and is a mohel, which is a ritual
circumciser,
and a wedding officiant, and is a member of a private Beit Din, a Jewish rabbinical court, which oversees conversions and circumcisions for people all around the world. In 2015, he created an organization, Magen HaBrit, that is committed to providing and preserving the sacred ritual of Jewish circumcision and the children who undergo it. He is widely published and has appeared in publications such as Haaretz, Tablet, the Jerusalem Post, the Jewish Press, Yisrael Hayom, Hadibrut, Ma'ariv, and Arutz Sheva. Chaim also is married with 4 children and lives here in Efrat, and by full disclosure, is literally my neighbor. We can throw rocks at each other. Not that we ever have, but from our
balcony. Not that we ever would.
Nor God forbid would we ever do that from our respective balconies. Why are we having this conversation today about Jews coming home? Well, Rabbi Leiter wrote an article on March 22nd in the Jerusalem Post, and I want to offer that anyone who wants links to both of the articles that we're going to reference to please be in touch with us. His article was entitled "The Complexities of Making Aliyah from America in Spite of Anti-Semitism." And what was fascinating about this is he quoted Hillel Fold social media post in his article, and the Jerusalem Post, which published the first article, also decided that they would invite Hillel to publish perhaps not a rebuttal, but a different opinion or a clarification. I will discuss what that is. And as I was just preparing a few minutes ago to click record and have this great conversation, I realized, wow, I mean, it's always significant for all of us, and the three of us all made Aliyah. Hillel, you as a much younger person, Chaim as an adult, myself as an adult. But actually, it was last month, 20 years ago, that I decided to make Aliyah after coming here, which is relevant to our conversation, coming here and realizing I could get work. And at the time, being a parent of five little children, 11 and under, and I didn't want to come here and be struggling. And I came here for what they call a pilot trip. I realized I could get work. We could gainfully live here. And I went home and told my wife, yes. And that August, we were on a plane. We had sold our house and put all of its contents into a 40-foot shipping container. But there's a little bit of controversy. And I think that I'm going to just leave it to the two of you to begin the dialogue, because we're probably all on the same page that you should come home, right? At any time. And Hillel, I came across another article of yours advocating that, your social media presence, you're a constant advocate of that. It's not just because of the war, but the war triggered something different. Rabbi Leiter, would you perhaps just begin the conversation? Why'd you write this article? Why now? You mentioned the anti-Semitism.
So the truth is, I saw Hillel's post, and something in it sort of stirred something up in me, wanting to talk about this issue, number one. But number two, I wanted to try to offer an expansive, in-depth, as much as you can do in an op-ed, conversation about what does it mean to make Aliyah? Why should one make Aliyah? And why should maybe, why are people holding off? Why are they not doing it? Hillel, I felt like your post, you'll correct me if I'm wrong, was a lot more focused on why people aren't making Aliyah. Is that true?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think we have to take a step back and realize that we have a tendency as a nation to repeat the same patterns over and over and over again. You know, not even on this topic necessarily, but on many topics, whether it's miracles that are happening right before our eyes, like they were in ancient Egypt, and like they were on Purim, like they were on Hanukkah. And we celebrate that now in retrospect. But if you lived in the time of Purim, you would say, you know, this is the near genocide of the Jewish people. Like, how are you celebrating, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I feel like we, as a Jewish people, we tend not to look into history and realize that we're making the same mistakes over and over again. And, you know, the miracles, and I know it's hard to say that word describing this horrible war, but it's also important that we take a step back and realize there's things that are bigger than us. And I think that the same pattern, the same behavior applies to Aliyah, right? I think throughout the generations, we've had many different narratives that we told ourselves as a nation why we should not go to Israel. Why did 80% of the Jews stay back in Egypt? I would imagine it's because they said, I'm Egyptian. I was born here. My parents were born here. My grandparents were born here. Don't talk to me about some land of milk and honey. I'm staying here. I'm Egyptian. I have a roof over my head and food on the table. I would imagine that was their narrative. And I would imagine that in the desert, when the Israelites famously sent 12 spies into the land of Israel, you know, they were 12 of the leading rabbis of the generation, and 10 came back and spoke badly about the land of Israel. And you have to ask yourself, how could that be? We just accept that story, but I don't know about you. I didn't think about it ever. How could it be the 10 rabbis spoke badly about Israel? Again, I wasn't there, but I imagine the narrative they told themselves is, I'm in the desert. I have, you know, food coming from the skies. I have clouds of glory. I am very religious. I have a straight line of communication with God. Why would I go into a country and build an economy and an army? I'd rather stay in the desert and be broom, right?
Well, one of my favorite things that you're picking up on is there's an amazing midrash, an amazing story told about that when the spies go in. And I think the rabbis, when they were writing it, were trying to understand what was the mindset of the spies who went in. How could they speak badly, as you said? And it talks about, I don't know if anyone out there has seen the amazing symbol that we have of Israel, where there's a long staff and then this amazing huge bundle of grapes that hangs below it. And it's about the height, or the, you know, it's the height of two people who are holding it on their shoulder. And what happened was, they said that the rabbi, that the people, the spies who went in, saw a human, like right next to them, where this was this huge bundle of grapes. And then off in the distance, they saw someone else holding a regular bundle of grapes, but they didn't know that it was a regular bundle of grapes. They thought that they were holding the same size grapes, the huge grapes, and it was just a little thing in their hand. And they said, oh my God, look, those people must be giants. Those people are giants because look at them. And so their perspective was such, it was almost like they had this mentality of being outside of Israel. They had this mentality that they thought, oh my God, there's no way we can make it in there. And you definitely talked about that, Hillel, correct?
So, yeah, I mean, you know, I'm not a psychologist and, you know, I'm not claiming to understand people's, you know, psychological mindset, but there is a lot to be said. And I'm sure, you know, you're familiar with the actual words in that verse in the Torah. It says that we were like grasshoppers, right. But it doesn't say we were like grasshoppers in their eyes because they're giants. It says Hayinu be'einenu kechagavim, we were in our own eyes like grasshoppers, which begs the question, what does that mean?
Right.
And what it means is that they, in their mindset, they didn't understand who we are as a nation, as a people, and what our duty is in this world and what our responsibility is in the world. And they were focused on the small little individuals and said, I'm going to stay in the desert. I'm more religious here. But God's like, this is not your job. Your job is not to stay in the desert and be religious. Your job is to get on an LL plane and go to Israel. Mm-hmm. And those narratives, and that's just two of many, but the narrative of I'm comfortable and I'm religious are two narratives that we're seeing today, repeated again, right?
Right.
We have most of the American Jewry who, you know, maybe some will say it, maybe some we won't say it, but let's be honest here. A lot of them are staying because they have their, you know, their Porsches and their Ferraris and their, you know, big houses and whatever. And, you know, yeah, they could send a couple of dollars to Israel because that kind of calms their guilty conscience. But no, they're comfortable. They're comfortable and they feel like I'm American. My parents are American. My grandparents are. Why would I leave? And then there's the other, you know, group of Jews outside of Israel that are, let's call it more right wing religiously, more, you know, let's call it more ultra orthodox. And if you talk to them, they'll say to you, go to Israel. I'm in Lakewood. I have my little ghetto. My kids are protected. They're religious. They wear black hats. I don't go to Israel where my kid get a tattoo and an earring. Israel's a secular country. My kid's going to go off the derech. My kid's going to become less religious if he goes to Israel. Which, number one, if your kid's going to get less religious by going to Israel, then you obviously didn't give him a very good education. But more importantly, more fundamentally, it is not your job to stay in Lakewood and be religious. It is your job to get on a plane and come to Israel. And so, you know, these narratives, they just keep repeating themselves time and time again. And it's time that as a nation, we step back, we look at history, we look at the script, we look at what we've always done, and we stop ourselves from making the same mistake over again.
I want to just interject, since it is my show, that Hillel, what's fascinating also, when you're just talking about comforts, creature comforts, specifically America, but I think the argument applies to the diaspora largely on the whole. Even if someone doesn't have a Porsche or Ferrari, if they're driving a Ford Windstar that's got a 5-year or 7-year lease, or they're running it into the ground and getting by. The other piece of the story of the spies is that at least in the desert, as one of you said, they were getting food. Life was pretty pro forma. It wasn't bad. It wasn't, but they were coming into something that they didn't know was the unknown. And I think even though you have to have your eyes closed to not see the miracles and not see the opportunities, which Hillel, you wrote about, I think it's still, people are a lot stuck in the, well, we're okay in Teaneck, we're okay in Miami, we're okay in Cleveland, and I'm not worried about the rockets that were just coming in from the north half an hour ago. But Chaim, let's come back to you. Oh, I just called you Chaim. I hope that's okay. That's You're perfect. Still Rabbi Leiter to me.
You can always call me.
All right, good. So you picked up on Hillel's post, and you tried to put it, which is a very interesting balance to say, okay, it's so, very Jewish, like Tevye on one hand and on the other hand. Mm-hmm. Help unpack that a little bit.
So I think one of the things I've been thinking about for a long time is how can we best be the Or LaGoyim, as we say. How can we best be the light to the nations? A lot of people are very uncomfortable with that phraseology on its own. We're not going to unpack all of that right now.
Jews more than anyone else.
Correct. But
this is a podcast correct. To Christians, so
that's
so
right.
We don't need to be embarrassed.
No, I'm not at all embarrassed. Don't worry. It was many years ago when I was sitting in yeshiva learning to become a rabbi, when somebody and I, you know, two of this, we weren't having a chavruta, we weren't studying together as partners, but we had a conversation about where are we best placed? Where are our efforts best placed to sort of teach the rest of the world the values that we have as Jews? And it was the first time anybody sort of pushed me on that. Cause I always thought, well, if you want to do the best teaching that you can possibly do, then you want to do it with the people. You want to be there. You want to be around and interacting with the people you want to, motivate to be better people. Right. And so my thought was, why wouldn't anyone want to be outside of Israel? How could you do it from inside of Israel? And my friend said to me, that's crazy. He said, the best place to possibly do this, the best place to possibly be the light unto the nations is here from Israel. And the funny thing was, you know, when I was talking to him many years ago, it seemed counterintuitive to me. And then since we have started having this, October 7th fallout, so to speak, I don't know what to call it, reaction from the world, I've actually seen more of our ability to influence the world in some ways, even though they might not like it, right? I think that we're actually polarizing the world in a way, and we're making it so that people understand, no, this is the right way to be in the world. We're doing the right thing. We're in the right, and it's driving people a little bit batty. But I still go back and forth, and that's kind of why you had that back and forth in the article, is that, is it really the best place for us to be? Are we really meant to be, all of us meant to be in the country now? And so I still ask the question.
Okay. So Hillel, actually, I wanted to pick up on something which you alluded to, and I made a note before we were speaking. You said, and this is not something that our Christian friends or even people who aren't as knowledgeable as you are not familiar with, about 80% of the Jewish people staying in Egypt. That's something that we know. It's not in the Bible, in the Tanakh per se. Can you just, first of all, educate those who didn't know that? Where does it come sure. from? What's the source?
So it's the first parsha, I don't know, how do you say parsha?
The first portion of the Torah.
Thank you. Torah portion in the book of Exodus. It's called the same name, Exodus. And it says that the Israelites left Egypt, and the word that the Torah uses is lachamushim, which literally means they had weapons. But the commentary, the most famous commentary, Rashi on the Torah, says that 1/5 of the Jews actually left, and 4/5 stayed back. It's not a very good point that it's not black on white in the Bible. But I don't, you know, Rashi is a pretty widely accepted commentator on the Torah. And, you know, just kind of back to the topic here. I mean, a disclaimer is in order. I have to give a disclaimer for everything I'm going to say from here on out, because it will offend some people. And I fully recognize that, you know, I may have a little bit of an extreme, or even maybe, let's say, a black and white, non-nuanced opinion on this. And of course, I want to just say, you know, I have tremendous respect for Rabbi Leiter. I'm not, God forbid, this isn't a personal thing. Let me just kind of get that out of the way.
By the way, your nature, if I can, is to be very black and white, but your nature also is to be super sensitive how other people perceive that. And I admire that.
I'll take that. Thank you. So, you know, I guess I'll start with a story and say that about, I don't know, maybe a year ago, I was eating dinner at a friend's house who's a little bit more, let's call it right wing, more religiously right wing, meaning they're more religious, more black and white. And we were having this conversation, and the wife looks at me and says, "Wait, you think all the Jews should be in Israel?" As if like, what is wrong with you? And I looked right back at her and I said, should all the Jews keep Shabbos? Should all the Jews eat kosher? I mean, does it not say in your prayers that we are longing and praying and facing Jerusalem for thousands of years? Yerushalayim Ircha, come back to your city, Jerusalem. Is that not what appears in your prayer book? Because in mine, it does say that. So like, I mean, I don't see any Jews saying, I'm a Jew, but not Shabbos. Like, I'll do everything else, but not Shabbos. No, The mitzvah of settling the land of Israel is right alongside Shabbos, keeping the Sabbath and keeping kosher and any other of the mitzvahs. And yeah, there's debate about whether it's one of the 613 mitzvahs in the Torah or not. And there's debate whether that applies today or not. All these things are great, but let's not forget that there's always been that debate again throughout history in the desert. There's always been that debate. And, you know, I not only do I think all Jews should be here. And again, disclaimer, I'm sorry whoever this offends, but I do firmly believe this. Not only should all Jews be here, but I think a Jew that doesn't realize they need to be here, and I'm very careful with my words. I'm not saying a Jew that doesn't come here, but a Jew that doesn't realize they need to be here and they call America their home, they are spitting in God's face. That's the way I view it. Wow. God's like, I gave you the country after thousands of years. I gave you the land of Israel. And we're like, yeah, but I'm more religious than like, but I think I'll stay there. Are you for real right now? Like, so anyway, yeah, I'm going to let Rabbi speak.
No, so
but we're going to let the Rabbi speak after a very quick break because I love that cliffhanger. Hold on, we're going to come right back. As remarkable and miraculous as Israel is, and its very existence a testimony to God's faithfulness, in many ways, Israel's like most other countries. Just as there are parents anywhere who have stronger and weaker parenting abilities, and adults become a product of situations in their lives that they cannot control, making their ability to raise and care for their own children even harder, that's true in Israel as well. The Genesis 1-2-3 Foundation is committed and takes the mandate seriously to care for the least of these, our brothers, our children. We're committed to bless and strengthen orphans and at-risk youth, to invest in them, to empower them, so that their future will be brighter than their past or their present. But Israel is unique in that there are always threats of war and terror which know no bounds. For children who come from homes that are not safe, sometimes the very scary reality of living in a community that's not safe is too much to bear. We are committed to turning orphans and at-risk youth into children of promise. We fund a variety of programs to help those most in need as widely as we can. We invite and encourage you to join us today so that we can ensure their brighter tomorrow. Please visit genesis123.co to find out more and to send your love and most generous donation today. Okay, Rabbi Leiter.
So I'm more pragmatic, I think, is what's happening. Is that you're talking about the 80%, the one-fifth that didn't come from Egypt to Israel. I think we're almost fighting a harder battle, right? We were slaves there, right? We're not slaves in America. We might be slaves to our cell phones and all of those things, but we're not slaves there, right? So we're almost fighting a harder uphill battle to get people to come to Israel right now in some ways. I think to pull them out of the diaspora. And my question is, and the reason I sort of framed the piece that I wrote the way that I did was because I'm looking at the gray zone. I'm looking not to get everybody, because I don't think it's a realistic goal. As much as I think it's a theological, philosophical, great goal, I don't think it's going to happen. And I think, what's my best way to reach those people and get to that middle gray area that's sort of on the fence? I've got to reach out to them in a way that doesn't push them away, but pulls them in. And my feeling is not that you might be hitting the same, like we might be working together in a good way. Like you might be hitting the people that I'm not, because I'm not being as forceful and as strong about it. But I think that my goal was to say, hey, if you're on the fence, I understand why you're on the fence. I see why you have these sort of the waffling and you're not 100% sure, but I can tell you why probably the main reason that you should be here is because there's no other country that's going to protect you like the state of Israel will. Right. That was sort of my driving force. There was like the state of Israel is the only place that you know for sure that, God forbid, things go wrong for you, you're going to be protected. Right. And so if you want to take that chance, you're taking a huge one in my book.
It took a little while for you to get to that in the article. Until I got to that point, I thought you were almost advocating, no, you know what? There are still more Jews who are dying here. Forget October 7th. There are more Jews dying here than anywhere else in the world on any kind of regular basis. But then you did what Hillel was saying earlier, as a nation, looking back historically, not just in terms of the 75 plus years of the state of Israel, but as a Jewish people. And then it raises the question and goes into the topic, which is in the headline of your article, anti-Semitism, is okay, until what point? And Hillel said in his piece, which I love how it weaves together so well, because Hillel, you wrote about, well, do you need to have a gun to your head? And if you had a gun to your head, then you'd get on a plane. But people don't perceive that there's a gun, or there's a threat. Is that anti-Semitism? Hillel, you were talking to somebody a year ago and having that conversation with someone who was, I mean, wow, what a great response. And amen to that, right? What you said, of course, everyone has to come here. That makes sense. But is it all the more so now?
Okay, so first of all, you have to unpack a lot of what was just said. Number one, let's differentiate between pragmatic and a goal, right? Let's just establish that we all agree, perhaps, I think, that the goal, ideally, is for all Jews to be in Israel. Now, from that to get up right now, get on a plane and come here, there's a huge leap. And I never said, nor will I ever say that every Jew needs to get up right now and come here. That was not what I was saying. What I was saying is, as a Jew, if you think you're home in America and you don't realize that Israel is your home, then there's a problem. Not you have to get up right now. So I'm not sure we even disagree. That being said, you know, if you present it that not all Jews belong in Israel, then, I mean, those Jews that are, you know, on the fence, they're like, oh, this rabbi, he's a righteous dude. He's a pretty smart guy. He said, I don't have to come to Israel. I'll just stay there.
No. Let me rephrase what I said, because I'm not sure I came across the right way. I said, from a practical standpoint, I don't think they're all going to do it. That's my problem. My problem is not that I'm saying to them, no, stay, it's fine. I'm saying, wait a minute. There is a chunk of people. I don't know if it's 10%, 20%. I don't know what it is. If it's a fifth, I have no idea what it is, but those people are a lost cause to me. I'm not trying to get them, but I know they're not going to come.
And you're not happy with it. You're not happy with it.
But saying that, don't you understand? You're it's a self-fulfilling prophecy, right? Because you're saying, I'm writing you off. You're not going to come here. And they're like, okay, well, this rabbi said, I'm not going to come here. I won't come here. Instead, what we should be saying is, you are all welcome. Our arms are open to you. Please come when you are ready to come. We want you here. Not 20% is going to stay. No, 100% are going to come eventually. Whenever that eventually is, some people will come now, some people come in a year, some people come in a decade, but all Jews will come to Israel. And then again, there are people, like you're right, that won't, but at least they should hear from, you know, the leaders in Israel, the rabbis, the smart and the righteous, that they are welcome here and that they should be coming here and that we believe they will come here. Not, you know, we know you're not going to come and we're going to write you off. I mean, what kind of, that's not a Jewish message.
I definitely do not believe that's my message. What I said was, when I wrote the article, in a way that I was hoping to reach the most people possible. I never in my article said, hey, you're not going to come. I'm telling you right now, I know this in the back of my head. I unfortunately know that there are people, I think even with a gun to their head, they might still not come. And I just, I don't know why that would be. But that could be the reality. So if I'm going to try to reach that, the largest number of the gray middle zone, I think it's a better way to do it is to say to them, hey, here is the best practical reason why you should come, right? I'm not going to slap you across the face. I'm not going to tell you you're doing the wrong thing. That's not my job. You know that, right? You're not an idiot. But you should know that this is the place for you. No one is closing their arms. No one's telling anybody not to come. But at the same time, if I sort of couch the message in, you know, you're just sinning, right? You're sinning there. Then who's going to listen to that? Oh, you might even lose all of the gray.
Of course, that's not the message. Of course. But I'll say like this. We all know that we don't know the reasons for the mitzvahs, right? We don't know why we do the things that we do. Hashem tells us to do them and we do them. Yes, we could speculate that, let's say, kosher food is healthier, and that's great. But once you start saying, keep kosher because it's healthy, tomorrow when scientists prove that it's not healthy, well, there goes all the mitzvahs, right? And so to say to Jews outside of Israel, you need to come here because this is the only place that will protect you, and here's where you're safest. Well, the answer is quite obvious. Really? Need I remind you about October 7th? I get this answer 100 times a day. I'm like, this is what will protect you. You're like, protect me? Do you know? And so again, I agree with what you're saying 100%, and I'm going to back it up with numbers in a second, that this is the safest place. But I don't think that should be the reason we tell people to come here. That might be a trigger. That might be say, okay, listen, you clearly America is no longer your home. Look around you. And therefore, come to Israel, your home, where it's the most beautiful country, and it's one of the happiest countries, and it's Zion, and let the quote unquote danger maybe trigger you. But I think it's a dangerous precedent to say you should come because of safety or because of anything else that's other than this is your country. That's number one. I will say though, just to kind of back up your point, because I obviously do agree with your point that this is the safest place. Even with October 7th and even with the horrible tragedies that we're facing right now, a statistic that I quote quite often, my father says it, I quoted in his name, and this is an unbelievable statistic that, you know, I think sums it all up. And that is that there has never been, listen to this, this is unbelievable, there has never been a 75-year period in the history of the Jewish people since the destruction of the temple in which so few Jews have been killed.
Wow.
Wow.
My heart's racing.
That's great.
So at the end of the day, every life that's lost is a tragedy. And, you know, as someone who lost his brother to terror, you don't need to tell me that. I know. But let's also take a step back and look at this historically and realize that this country is actually protecting us in a very real way, not in a Mother Teresa kumbaya way, but in a real way. This is the 75 years that never had so few Jews killed in the world.
But is that the selling point that you're safer here? We all spoke about anti-Semitism and that being a push. And I'm a little bit older than you. I was probably more active than either of you in the Soviet Jewry movement. But, you know, I thank God for this anti-Semitism in the Soviet Union, because that's what kept Jews Jewish and eventually pushed a million plus to come here, because they couldn't make it there. But that's not, I don't think, Hillel, you're a marketer. That's not the marketing point. What's the marketing point? How are we getting them? How are we getting the small number that Chaim's already figuratively written off?
So I 100% do not think that that is a selling point. I think that is a dangerous selling point.
Okay.
There could be many selling points. You have to know your audience. We're talking marketing, know your audience. That's good. 101, right? And so it really does depend who you're talking to. But number one, and again, this is my opinion, and we can debate this. It's fine. This has been my experience. I fundamentally do not believe the consensus that seems to be something that I don't know who's telling people this. I do, but I'm not going to get into that. That if you come to Israel, you have to lower your quality of life. That is, I'm speaking to five people a week who say this to me. Like, yeah, but I'm not going to make as much money, but I'm not going to. And I'm like, listen, man, I don't know who's telling you this. And again, I do, but it doesn't matter. But I'm sitting here talking to you guys in my house in Beit Shemesh, beautiful home, amazing family, like. What I don't feel, I just came back from Woodmere 2 weeks ago. Do you think I feel like I live a lower quality of life than they do? Absolutely not. So let's start with the fact that it used to be, when all of us were younger, that if you came to Israel, there was only one reason you'd come to Israel, and that is because you're a hardcore Zionist. Because you remember, you couldn't get deodorant in this country. You couldn't get tuna fish, right? It was a third world country. And so if you came here for one reason only, and that is because you were a hardcore Zionist. Someone recently said something to me that really resonated. He said, I came to Israel not because I'm a Zionist, but because I'm a capitalist. Because this is where it's all going on. The whole business sector, the epitome of the tech world, is here in Israel. You can live as good, if not a better quality of life. And I'm not talking spiritually, materialistically. If, and this is a big if, I'm going to be very clear here. If you are good at what you do and you're willing to work hard. If you're at the bottom of the chain and you're getting minimum wage in America, then your minimum wage there will be more than your minimum wage here. True. But if you're good at what you do, and I don't care what you do, by the way, it doesn't matter. But if you're good at what you do and you're willing to work hard and you're resourceful, you can make as much money here as you make there, if not more. And so let's start with the fact that coming here is no longer tied to, you know, a serious sacrifice of quality of life. That's no longer the case. That's number one. Number two, I think, you know, let's just say it as it is. What has to happen, right? When we were growing up, or I should say when I was growing up, one of the questions, I had a few questions that always bothered me, but one of the questions was, you know, when there was dangerous rhetoric in Germany, it was like, okay, it was just words, right? Big deal. But once they started legislating against Jews, Nuremberg laws, what were the Jews thinking? What did they think was going to happen? And the answer is, they're like, it's not going to happen here. This isn't Spain. This is enlightened Germany, and this is not going to happen here. And don't compare it to any of the other places that the Jews were massacred or expelled from. This is enlightened. This is Germany. It will never happen here. And when they legislated against Jews, they still said it will never happen here. So I'm thinking, I'm looking at this from the side, and I'm talking about family members that said that. I'm looking at it from the side. I'm like, are you guys like, what are you smoking? Right? And so I'm looking at the reality today, and I'm like, okay, there are anti-Semites in Congress. There is Kanye West declaring his love for Hitler. There is Kyrie Irving, one of the best NBA players, telling people to take down a sign that says, I'm a proud Jew. There are pro-Hamas protests in Teaneck, New Jersey. There are Jews being beaten in the streets. There are Jews being killed in the streets. What on earth has to happen for Jews to realize they need to get the hell out of there fast? Because things are getting really, really bad. Really, really fast. You have to understand the transition from dangerous rhetoric to extermination took years in Germany. Here, October 8th, the anti-Semites came out to play and they haven't gone home since. So what's going to happen in a month from now? What's going to happen in six? What, you think the genie is going back into the bottle? It's game over. That's it. It's not going back to the way it was. It's only going to get worse. So if I'm a Jew in America, and again, I want to be clear with my disclaimer. I'm not judging anyone. I came here when I was 15 with my family. I didn't make any sacrifices, so I'm a big talker, okay? That being said, if I'm in America right now driving my Porsche and living my life, I'm having a great time. But if I'm even remotely able to look inside with introspection and actually have some self-awareness of my surroundings, I look at the reality, I'm like, oh my God, this is not my home. Like, I am now at the mercy of a foreign government that could not care less about me, and I need to get on a plane right now. with all the tragedy that we're experiencing, the fundamental difference is that how we retaliate, how we react, and how we respond to threats is in our hands. Yeah. Even though we have diplomatic pressure, it's in our hands. We are the Baal HaBayit. We are the owner here. This is our home. That to me is the fundamental difference.
Well said. Chaim, I know you want to respond, keeping on the, we're going to do a break and then another cliffhanger and let you and come right back to you.
The restoration of Jewish sovereignty in the land of Israel was an earth-shattering event. For Christians, it was a confirmation that God always keeps his covenantal promises. Today, we are blessed to see God's fingerprints in the modern miracle of the land of Israel playing out in our lives among the people and in the state of Israel. This year, on the occasion of Israel's 75th anniversary, the Genesis 123 Foundation has been privileged to bring together 75 Christian leaders from around the world to lend their unique voices, sharing their personal faith experiences relating to Israel and their in-depth insight into Israel's history and spiritual significance, creating an historical, one-of-a-kind, high-end coffee table book, Israel the Miracle. Israel the Miracle's stunning imagery will fill your home with the hope of fulfilled promises and conversations about Israel. It's a perfect gift to anyone for any occasion, and most of all, to yourself. You'll also be a blessing to Israel, knowing that the proceeds will go to bless Israelis of all backgrounds. Be a part of Israel the Miracle and bring the land, the people, and the state of Israel into your heart and into your home. Visit IsraelTheMiracle.com to get your limited edition copy
okay.
today.
Chaim, you have a lot to unpack on that, but I do want to, this is great. I'm not prompting you, but I do want to know also, in addition to what Hillel said, what are the selling points for the people who are on the edge? But respond to what Hillel said.
So the first thing I want to say is, I think one of the points I was trying to make is that not just that there's danger out there, not that there's this, only that there's this possibility, but I think that I was trying to impress upon people outside of Israel, you're actually in more danger than we are here. Because all of the factors are there. We know who our enemies are. We know where they are. We know who's going to protect us. We have a government that's going to protect us. God forbid the tide ever turns past what you were just talking about, Hillel, which is absolutely right. When the tide actually turns and gets, more, what do we want to say? Ma'asi, as we say in Hebrew, right? If it gets more than just talk and it becomes more action, I don't think that there are people who are there who are going to protect the Jews who are not in Israel. And that makes it more of a risk to be outside of Israel.
And the Jews can't protect themselves.
They're not armed.
They don't have, right. They don't have the weapons the whole, that our sons yeah. have going to the army.
One of my favorite shuls, synagogues that I go to when I visit New York is in Riverdale. It's the Hebrew Institute of Riverdale. I don't want to give any big secrets here, but, they have, about, I think, four people monitoring outside and with their sunglasses and the earpiece and the whole thing. Yeah. Only one of them is armed. And there's three other people that have no idea what they're doing. And they're just there to look tough. And I'm like, guys, I worry for you. This is not, you need four people at least. But okay. Second thing, what's the selling point? I'll tell you I recently heard someone talking about this and saying and the term that they used is actually that Israel has an amazing superpower. And the superpower actually is, and I knew it inside, like in my kishkas, like in my guts, I knew this, but they put it so perfectly. And they said that we are sort of a country that is living in two worlds, if you will. On the one hand, we're progressive, we're democratic, we're doing all the amazing things, right? We're individualistic, all those things that we see in the West that we love, that a lot of us who came from America, myself included, didn't want to give up. But at the same time, we're tribal. That we have this collectivism, that we have more children, that we're focused more on family. And it actually, his point was, it's the reason that we fell a little bit in the last year, but we were the fourth and now the fifth happiest place to be in the world. And that's right. Because we're not alone. We never feel alone. And you know how something tragic happens in America and the flags go onto the cars or the porches or the front yard for like a minute and then they go away a minute later. Right. And it never leaves. It's always part of our being here in this country. And I think you won't find that maybe anywhere else.
That's correct. Hello. Anything you want to add to that?
I mean, again, rule 101 when you're on a panel is create controversy. So it might seem to your listeners like me and Rabbi Leiter are ready to kill each other, but we see eye to eye on this issue clearly. I think maybe where we don't see eye to eye is, how how bad the situation is. Perhaps, you know, I do think we both right. understand that it's getting pretty bad, but I lost hope. I think that it's game over for the Jews outside of Israel. It really is. I don't know how anyone can see that. And again, to say it again, I'm not saying everyone get up right now and get on a plane. I understand people have elderly parents. They have children with specific needs that they have to be in America, whatever the case may be. And I'm not dismissing those things or belittling them. Everyone has their reasons, and I'm not saying they should pick up right now. But there's a very big difference between picking up right now and saying, okay, this is my home. It's not your home. You have to know that. And I heard a story that really hit home for me. It was amazing that some big rabbi, I don't remember who it was, came to Israel, and his students asked him, Rabbi, what do you miss most from America? And he said, I miss the longing for Israel.
Wow.
Isn't that beautiful? So, you know, I think, and I say this to my friends all the time, out of love, not out of, God forbid, judgment, that, you know, they need to be prepared. They need to get it into their head, you know, and keep telling themselves as comfortable as their, you know, Maserati might be and as comfortable as whatever, you know, it's time and, you know, be prepared, right? Not in an alarmist kind of way, like, oh my God, the end of the world is coming. No, but things, you know, things are getting pretty, I mean, take this latest, event of Israel, you know, obviously accidentally killing 7 aid workers in Gaza, right? I mean, you know, Israel immediately, you know, apologized and they're going to conduct a transparent investigation into what happened, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And fine, we're doing what we can. But, I mean, the anti-Semitism around this event could not be any clearer. I mean, we're talking about 100 and however many hostages still in the dungeons of Gaza without water, food, you know, sunlight or medicine. We're talking about 1,400 people massacred, and the world is obsessed with what? 7 people who were accidentally killed. Like, there is no other way to explain this other than anti-Semitism. There is no other way. And so, again, like, right now it manifests in, you know, horrible social media posts, in maybe a protest in the streets. But, like, what do people think is the next step? What do they think is going to happen? You think this isn't going to escalate into horrible, horrible violence and eventually, you know, murder? I mean, wake up. Wake up. That's where it's going, and it's not going to take 2 years. So, you know, again, I don't want to encourage people to come for the wrong reasons, but if there's ever been a trigger that says to you, now's the time, that trigger is very much here right now.
I'm responding, and then I have a question for the both of you.
Yep. I honestly couldn't agree more. In one way that I agree is that when I first moved to Israel, I felt like that argument was always used. I didn't even use the word trigger. I used hyperbole. Like, it was like, you know, one day, maybe down the line, there might be something that happens again. And, you know, you might want to be here instead of there, because who wants to pick up and, you know, leave when that horrible thing happens? And I used to think of it as like, oh, I guess that's a good reason to make Aliyah. It's a good reason to immigrate to Israel. And then now with this, I very much feel like we're on the same page. I think that things are getting much worse. I pray that it'll never get to a point where, you know, it has been in the past, but I can't see it getting better anytime soon, not for any particular reason.
Agree with you. Question then. We're all Israelis. Hillel, you've been one since you're 15. Chaim and I since a little bit later than that. What does Israel need to do as a nation? What do we need to do to when that happens? Because Hillel, you said something interesting, that not everyone needs to get on a plane now, but people need to be ready. But at some point, you know, probably what won't happen is what happened in Nazi Germany and Europe, is that it's too late and you couldn't get out. And then, of course, the British were occupying Israel and wouldn't let Jews in. We're not going to have that scenario. But I mean, we've done it with 1 million Jews coming out of the Soviet Union and bought temporary housing and put people up in tents in the 1950s. But what does Israel need to do from your respective perspectives in order to sow the ground so people can come and feel more comfortable?
So first of all, I'm going to play devil's advocate here, if I may.
Okay.
Why do you think that's not going to happen? Why do you think that there's not going to be a point where the government of whatever country is going to say, listen, you do not belong there. You are American. You are European. Okay. Stay where you are. And Palestine belongs to the Palestinians. We are not letting you go to Israel. That's so unrealistic to you? Is it any more unrealistic than concentration camps and the enlightened Germany?
So taking away landing rights even for El Al, which will be the only plane flying.
Maybe they'll ban El Al. We can make up scenarios.
Okay.
Like, I'm at the point right now that I will not say anything is impossible. Because would you have believed that, you know, any of this would have happened? Would you have believed that after what we experienced on October 7th, that there would be anyone in the Western world who doesn't stand by us? Right. Would you have believed that Kanye West, none of this makes sense. We would never believe any of this would have happened. Okay. So I'm no longer able to say, I don't think that that will happen.
Okay.
I'm not.
Okay. As far as Israel is concerned,
you know, I mean, this is a pretty broad topic and there's a lot to be said on this topic. But at the very foundation, basic level, it has to be a lot friendlier and easier to make Aliyah. Like, you know, from the job market to the real estate to just, you know, Nefesh B'Nefesh obviously does an amazing job in terms of like getting you your, you know, your Israeli ID, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But even with Nefesh B'Nefesh, the paperwork, it's still not easy enough. And so I think it is our responsibility as the only Jewish state in the world that looks out for our brothers and sisters to remove all friction. Remove all friction. As a Jew, you want to come to Israel, it is as easy as going to the supermarket. Obviously, I'm exaggerating, but any unnecessary friction needs to be removed. And I think it should be a top priority of the state of Israel, really, because, you know, on so many levels, when we have larger numbers here, you know, it will benefit the country in very, very real, tangible ways, militarily, economically, in every way possible, basically. So it's in our best interest, as in the state of Israel, to facilitate and encourage more Aliyah and more Jews in this country.
Did I just hear the announcement of the Hillel full party running for Knesset in the next election?
You absolutely did not.
Did not. Okay, just checking. I thought maybe I'd get a scoop. All right. Chaim, what does Israel need to do?
So I'll tell you, the right around the time as our two articles were being published in the Jerusalem Post, there was a piece that came in the Forward, and I've lost more more respect for the Forward as the days have gone on. And the title of the op-ed was, what Israel is doing is making life less safe for Jews in America is basically, and so why are so many people supporting the war? And it's exactly the opposite in my mind. What Israel needs to do, and what I think Israel is doing, is to show the rest of the world, the Jews of the rest of the world, and maybe even the rest of the world in total, but the Jews of the rest of the world, how to stand up for themselves, how to do the right thing. And that we're not going to back down and we're not going to stop doing what we're doing because you all of a sudden feel like, oh, if we would just go away or hide. I mean, this just sounds ridiculous that Jews would even think something like that. But if you guys would just stop what you're doing, everything would be fine for us. So please stop making so much noise. It sounds ridiculous, but it's like a cycle that we've heard before in other communities. I think Israel needs to show how to stand up for itself, how to stand up for yourselves, how to protect yourselves, and how to do the right thing. And the part about how to do the right thing, I think that applies to the entire world. And that's what I hope we're doing.
Very nice.
I have to say something about that, because let's go back to the beginning of the conversation. What I said before is that we keep repeating the same patterns as a nation, right?
Yes.
And again, like what happened in every single empire without exception, right? 80% stayed in Egypt. What happened in Rome? What happened in Greece? What happened in Nazi Germany? What happened in Soviet? We, as a Jewish people, we think that what we're going to do is say, we're going to avoid your discrimination and your persecution by saying, we're just like you. We're going to assimilate. We are more, in fact, we're more Roman than the Romans. We are more liberal than the most liberal Americans today. We're the most liberal people in America, the Jews. And we're like, hey, listen, don't hate on us. We're just like you. And then what happens? Same script over and over and over again. They say, you're not just like us. What are you talking about? We have a tool that we've developed to show you that you're not just like us. It's called anti-Semitism. And so, you know, the concept of, oh, let's just be quiet and let's just be like them and then the hatred. Do you know how many generations Hitler went back to determine whether someone's Jewish or not? You think
he's worse than we are.
So that's the tragedy of it, is that in every generation, we need them, the world, to remind us that we're Jewish. It's insane. But it's the same thing over again today. You know, so I literally have gotten tweets, kid you not, from people saying, literally, sit down, Jew. Stay quiet, Jew. Really? Mm-hmm. In fact, someone this morning, I shared someone else's tweet because someone wrote to them something like, yeah, like, sit down, Jew. And his response was, we don't do that anymore. we don't sit down because you told us to sit down, you know? So the mistakes that we have always made, we continue to make and we're making today. But from my perspective, I don't know if it's because I'm insane or because I'm brilliant, but it seems to me like no one is seeing the clarity that I'm seeing. I don't know. It's like, how do I see this and no one else sees this? But like, wake up, people. Stop making the same mistakes that our ancestors made and their ancestors made, and just open your eyes. You know, it's kind of like the famous story, of the storm. It's a big storm, right? And you guys know the story. And the guy gets on the roof, right? And you know, people are starting to get on boats and whatever. And then a boat comes by and this guy's on the roof and they say, get in the boat. He says, no, 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 God will save me. And they're like, okay, whatever. A bigger boat comes by. Get in the boat. No, God will save me. Okay. And then a helicopter comes and get on the helicopter. No, God will save me. And then in the water, you know, and then it kills him. And he goes with the guy. He's like, God, I don't understand. I had faith. Why didn't you save me? And God's like, why didn't I save you? I sent you a boat. I sent you a helicopter. Why didn't you get on it? It's like we don't see what's right before our eyes, for better and for worse, by the way. The miracles. And it's a hard word to use when you're in such deep mourning and devastation. But the miracles, the open miracles, the nature-bending miracles that we're seeing in this war, as far as I'm concerned, are equal to the splitting of the sea. I mean, wow. You tell me how it's possible that a terrorist organization that's literally miles away from you fires tens of thousands of deadly rockets into the most densely populated cities and casualties are in the single digit. I mean, I don't know. You could explain it, but you tell me where these empty spaces are in a country smaller than New Jersey. Like, these are not hidden miracles. You tell me how a person who was told by every single military and every single government that you cannot detonate rockets mid-air built a system that detonates rocket at 96% precision. So we, because we always do this, we're like, ah, yeah, it's normal, makes sense. What? God is sending you a helicopter. Get on the darn helicopter. These are miracles of unprecedented proportions. And we're just looking at it like, yeah, that makes sense. Six-day war. Sure. War of independence. People with sticks and stones beating five armies. And we're like, yeah, that makes sense. Dude, open your eyes, man. God is right in front of us pulling the strings. And yes, there are some things that are happening that make you question, how could God do this? And I don't have the answer to that question. And it's a valid, legitimate question. It's a question for, you know, all generations, right? How do good things happen to bad people? But, you know, with that, if you look at this war through a human lens, you're going to lose your mind.
Excellent. One more break, and then we're going to come back and finish up. Friends, Israel's at war, and the war may get worse before it gets better. Much worse. It's going to be a long war because the enemy is the epitome of evil. It's not just a matter of overcoming troops on a battlefield, but overcoming a theology, an ideology, an evil one. While the Genesis 123 Foundation has been overwhelmed with the support of so many donations to the Israel Emergency Campaign, there's so much more that needs to be done. We've invested your donations that we've received so far strategically to make the biggest impact possible, whether helping with soldiers and their equipment and personal needs, to providing civilian security for outlying border communities, to relocating and settling several families from near the Gaza war zone, launching the global petition drive to support Israel in the face of pressure for a ceasefire, and long-term needs for at-risk children, traumatized now more than ever before. Please take a moment to pause this conversation right now and go to love.genesis123.co and donate generously. We value your trust, and we will keep all donors informed about how and where your donations are being used to contribute to make the biggest impact possible. And when you use that link, love.genesis123.co, you can also send your prayers and words of encouragement to Israelis of all backgrounds. Just sending your love, something that we need so desperately. Thank you, and God bless you and your loved ones.
Okay, Hillel Chaim. I'm so grateful. Hillel, you asked rhetorically if you're crazy or if you're a genius. I vote for the genius side. And not only that, but you're super, you've not well thought it through, but you're super articulate in explaining it. And it's very passionate. I think I hope this conversation goes out very widely and will be a positive trigger. Chaim, you were nodding actively before. What did you want to add to that?
I think that this is not, I don't know if this is where we want to end the podcast on, but the thought that kept going through my mind when you were saying that, Hillel, was that when people are not noticing all of these miracles that are right in front of them, I think what's happening in this country right now is that we're not used to a war as protracted as this one. And we're losing our gusto. We're losing our steam. And we're also, I mean, if you think about it, you quoted all these other miracles, right? The 67, right? All these wars that were in and out, and we were done and we won, like, without, in, you know, and this is the longest thing we've ever gone through. Now, I'm not saying that this is the right way to feel. But I feel like, Israelis might be questioning their own, our own abilities when it comes to the military front. And they shouldn't, because as you've already pointed out, as, friends that I have who are serving have pointed out, the numbers of people that we have lost are so significantly, staggeringly low. But the fact that it wasn't a quick in and out, and it's not what we're used to. And now we're thinking, cause it is on the horizon. I mean, it does look like we're on our onto the next phase, and more of the people who are serving in the reserves are going back. I think people are just, you know, sort of dreading that a little bit, but I think that they have to realize that this is what we need to do. It is the reality that we're faced with. And it's unfortunate that it is the reality, but it is our reality, and we have to see it through to completion.
Question for you, Hillel, you were just there, and Hillel Chaim, you triggered this talking about what's coming, but we haven't spoken about Lebanon per se. And this is my podcast for next week is an analysis of the first 6 months of the war and militarily and on all other levels. But when something heats up with Hezbollah and we're seeing all the reservists go back, and they know where they're going and they know how they're going, but we've all been living through this for the last 6 months, and there's grief and there's trauma, even if we've not been impacted personally. But Hillel, you were just in the States, and Chaim, I don't know, we haven't spoken in a little while. I don't know when the last time you were. Do you feel safer in here versus there?
Yeah, so I just want to, if I may, with one sentence address what was just said. And of course, you know, we've all had those thoughts, like, how come this war is taking so long when we're just fighting these like little punks, these like terrorists, when we beat armies? How could that be? And someone said something to me today that I fundamentally agree with, and I didn't think about it till he said it, which is that, you know, there's, you know, in a science experiment, right? There's the control group, and there's the, you know, the things that change. What are they called? The not parameters.
Variables.
Let's see. Variables. Thank you. Right. So what's changed here? Have we gotten weaker? Is that what changed? No. What changed is the type of war that we're fighting. The world has never known a war that's being fought underground. Like, this is unprecedented. And not only are we going to win this war, and yes, it will take longer than conventional wars, but Israel will forever, after this war is over, be the world leader in urban warfare. And
yes,
the world's biggest leaders are going to come to us to learn how we did what we did. It's not us being weaker. It's the war getting harder. So I just wanted to address that point.
And by the way, as you do, rockets coming in from Lebanon at this moment. But yes, I agree with your point.
You know, I think, to quote my father again, you know, we say, I'm going to say in 2 weeks from now on Pesach, we say the verse or whatever you want to call it, of Vihisha Amda Labotena. This is what stood for our forefathers throughout the generations. Shelo Echad Bilvada Madalahinu Chal. It's never been one enemy. And so, you know, there's a lot of ways to explain that verse, but my father always says the miracle of our enemies is that they never stop fighting each other. They're always fighting each other. Instead, you know, again, God forbid defeat us, because Hashem has our back. But could you imagine what would happen if Hamas and Hezbollah and Iran and sat in a room and saw eye to eye on everything, which is the complete and total destruction of the state of Israel? No politics. Let's just bomb the heck out of them. I don't know. I don't want to think what would happen, but we have the politics, right? Hezbollah and Hamas are at each other's throats, and Iran, it's like unbelievable. It's like they're helping us help, like they're doing our job for us, you know? That being said, you know, Hezbollah is significantly, significantly stronger than Hamas. So that is a threat. There's no question about it. I do think, and I don't know, I'm not a military strategist, and I don't know what the thought process is if and when this war breaks out with Hezbollah, if we're going to go in on foot or whatever, or if it will be more of a conventional war between Lebanon and Israel. But I think that, you know, the military and the political leadership in Israel, you know, I don't think they're kidding themselves. I don't think that they think there's even a chance that war is not going to break out. It's just a question of when, unless, of course, Qatar and the other countries pressure Hezbollah enough to step back, which, let's be honest, I don't think that's going to happen. So I think
you have a better chance of all the Jews coming home.
So I think it's, you know, it's inevitable. You know, I don't know if I want it to happen sooner or later. I don't know, but it's going to happen. And, you know, the from my perspective, the thought that I want to leave your listeners with is that we know how it ends. We know how it ends. That's it. You know, there's a famous Gemara. And again, you guys know this, but there's a famous Gemara. I think it's in Makos. Rabbi, correct me if I'm wrong, with four rabbis are walking, you know, by the place where the temple once stood. And there was a fox walking there. And they start crying. How could this be? The destruction of our holiest place.
Wow.
And famously, Rabbi Akiva, one of the rabbis, starts laughing. They're like, what on earth are you laughing about? He says, what are you crying about? He said, what do you mean about a fox walking on our holiest of holiest? He's like, that's why I'm laughing, because we have a prophecy that says that foxes are going to walk in the place of the temple. And if this prophecy came true, clearly all the other prophecies are going to come true too. And that's the way you have to look at this entire war with Hezbollah, with Hamas, with everything. We knew this was going to happen, right? Anybody who didn't wasn't paying attention. In fact, I personally, on my own social media, less than a week, I think, before the war started, wrote a post and I said, between Russia and Ukraine, America and Iran, America and China, Israeli politics, American, like, we're getting to a boiling point and something big is about to happen and Israel will be at the center of it. I wrote that. So, you know, if you think, like, you know, this is not going to happen, or we're going to, you're not paying attention. It's going to happen. But again, we know the ending because it's the same script over and over and over again. And the ending is that our enemies, whether it's Hamas, whether it's Hezbollah, whether it's Iran, whoever it is, will join their good buddies, the ancient Roman Empire and the ancient Greek Empire and the ancient Egyptian Empire and the ancient Nazi Empire and the ancient Soviet. And I can keep going. Anyone historically who came and stood in our face is no more. And that is, and that will be the destiny of our enemies today.
Excellent. Rabbi Leiter, last word. What, for, before you say something, I know you and I know it wasn't intended, but the way the Jerusalem Post published the articles on the same page, when, because we actually still, some of us actually read newspapers, it was almost as if it was a debate, and it wasn't. And you were, and you did, you approached it from one perspective and you quoted Hillel, and Hillel reinforced what he was saying. This has not been a debate. This has been a fabulous conversation. And I want to acknowledge and be grateful for you for just triggering this conversation, and Hillel, for you being also gracious enough to be a part of it. But what's the last word? What do we need to talk about in terms of Jews coming home and safety and impediments to making that happen?
I think the thing that, I'm not sure this is what you wanted the last word to be.
Go ahead.
After hearing Hillel and all that you just said, it's sort of the reason that I want to say, and it's the message I want to send to, I guess, everyone, but really to the Jews of the world, to tell them that, like, we can see the future, like the prophecy you were talking about. We can see the future, and the future is a place here in Israel that's peaceful. It's not that, it's not the hardest thing to get to. We need to root out these people who are doing these horrible things. And after that, the coexistence is actually plausible. And I think that the more people around the world believe that and subscribe to the philosophy that evil is evil and good is good, and sometimes you have to do bad things to get rid of evil, that's the way that we're going to get to a better world. And that's where we are right now. And I really pray that Israel does what it needs to do. And when that comes to our north, and still to our, a little bit to our south, and if it's anybody else in any other direction, it's coming for them. And we saw that this past week.
Beautiful. Thank you.
And I'll add, I know you get last word, but I just want to say one last offer to your listeners. If they come to Israel, shawarma's on me.
I was going to quote that. Yeah, I know. It's excellent. Wow. Chaim, Hillel, what a delightful conversation. Super engaging. It was, I didn't really know where it was going to go. And I'm super grateful for you both joining. It wasn't just a conversation about current events. We're talking about something timeless. When Hillel first started at the beginning talking about us as a nation, that's a nation going back thousands of years. And this is a conversation, hopefully people will listen, but as Hillel said, we know where it goes. We know the ending. I think in a sense, though no one elects themselves as prophets, in a way you're both fulfilling that role. We'll know hundreds of years or thousands of years from now who actually gets deemed that, but in many ways, a quite a prophetic conversation. Thank you both for being part of this.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
We always wrap up with the opportunity that we've been promoting now. Gosh, I think it's 3 years. It's called From Jonathan's Bookshelf. We want you to share this conversation. We want you to subscribe and listen and let other people know about it. So all you need to do is comment
and share this, the link to this conversation, to this episode. And every month we pick one person at random to receive a book until, well, 6 months ago, until just before the war began, we were promoting other people's books. But 2 weeks before the war began, the Genesis 123 Foundation came out with a stunning coffee table book called Israel, the Miracle, 75 essays by Christian leaders all over the world, which in itself is very prophetic now that it's come out. So I want you to follow, like, comment, share this episode, and maybe you'll walk home, so to speak, with a copy of Israel, the Miracle. We're always grateful that our podcast is sponsored by our friends at the Willow Run Greenhouse in Culpeper, Virginia. If you're ever in the area, pop in and thank them for helping make conversations like this possible, and also the Coyne family for their meaningful sponsorship. Inspiration from Zion and the Genesis 123 Foundation, our programs are always made possible by donations, so please consider joining us to help continue the dialogue and build bridges. This episode, Hillel mentioned the hostages, 134 people who were kidnapped 180 days ago, living underground, living without water, without food, no sunlight, unfortunately, many of whom we know already dead. Let this be in their honor that by next episode, they all will be free. If you'd like to sponsor a future episode in honor or memory of a loved one or special occasion, please be in touch at inspirationfromzion@gmail.com. We'd always love to hear your questions and comments and to be part of the dialogue, and invite you to send any questions, especially ones about traditional Judaism, for our Ask the Rabbi programs. Please share this with others who will also find it of interest, and continue to join us right here as we bring you more meaningful conversations about unique topics in Israel that you won't hear anywhere else. Wherever you are in the world, I send my prayers that you're healthy and well from right here in the Judean Mountains. God bless you.